Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast. My name is Paul Ellis, and I'm your host for these programs about developments in this fast-growing industry. Making the Sustainable Investment Case, a course on the Harvard Extension School platform that was launched successfully in 2022, has returned for the 2025 spring semester. New for 2025 is a two-part section on nature and investment, drawing on the cutting-edge work of Irina Likhachova in biodiversity and fixed income. Instructor Graham Sinclair is once again using fund labs, projects, for hands-on experiential learning with four successful investment managers, Bill Page, Liz Simme, Garvin J. Bush, and Christopher Halden. Sinclair says, "We want students from a broad range of backgrounds. We have a fast-paced and rigorous overview, exploring investments in sustainability from multiple perspectives. The course will not be boring." And I can confidently say that followers of the Sustainable Finance Podcast and practitioners of sustainable investment are in for a treat today and won't be bored by my guest, Graham Sinclair. Hello, Graham, and welcome to the Sustainable Finance Podcast.
Hello, Paul. I'm a longtime fan of the podcast and appreciate what you do. Thank you for having me on.
Well, listen, today's a real pleasure for us, and we want to tell our followers and investment practitioners in the audience about the hands-on experiential learning opportunity for with successful investment managers using Fund Labs projects. They're new to me. If you could give us a little explanation, that would be helpful.
My pleasure. Well, when I was invited at Harvard to come back to teaching, I used to teach MBAs a decade ago, and life happened and other priorities. When I was approached to come back to teaching at Harvard Extension School, which is a global platform, and to teach digitally, we were exploring this during the quarantine. My mandate was not just to explore what it means to be making the sustainable investment case, but to make sure it's applicable was my key directive. And what I found in the first iteration of teaching the course is while I was using case studies and other examples and expert interviews, I have a catalog of 200 expert interviews now, I was still missing something of the students getting their hands dirty, if you will. I don't know about you, but I learn a lot from actually doing things. And so Fund Labs was an answer to that question. And the labs part is important because, as you'll appreciate, in the so-called hard sciences or engineering, on site somewhere, you've got to break something or you've got to test something. Something can work and not work. And I'm very clear with the students on these mini projects that they do with the four different fund managers. Something can break, something can not work, and that's also learning.
Yes. Well, you know, I've been doing some guest lecturing recently, and you're exactly right, because you never know what you're going to encounter in the middle of a presentation from a student who has a completely different perspective from yours, right?
Yeah, very true, very true. And for me, I've got fund managers that are based mm-hmm. in North America. I've got two in the US. I've got one in Canada. I've got one in Sweden. And even that diversity starts to throw up different aspects. You know, Europe has a very, very different worldview, different regulatory environment. Our good friends in Canada, you know, similar to America, but living very differently, especially now because they have a prime minister who a decade ago gave that the Long Horizon speech in London. And for me, that best matches what I'm trying to do with the students, because when I'm teaching sustainability, I have to be teaching it with a global mindset. I have to be using examples from around the world. And for me, that's what's so powerful about teaching at Harvard Extension School is the fact that my students are around the world. This semester, for example, I've got someone in Singapore, I've got someone in Kuwait, I've got someone in Pakistan, I've got someone in Brooklyn. So from all around the world, because that's the only way to really get at sustainability issues, in my view.
Okay. Now, we're going to go back in time, Graham, because you founded SINCO, and I'm going to ask you to explain what SINCO is, back in 2006, to work with institutional investors and stakeholders. What motivated you to do this 20 years ago? We're going back in time in the sustainable investment movement. I was there, as you know, at that time. But what motivated you to found Cinco?
Yeah, let me first say I really appreciate fellow travelers like you, Paul. There's much to be learned from humans who've been doing this for a long time, especially their BS filters are much better than some of those people who've just arrived right now. Yeah. It was two decades ago, 2005, that I headed up to Boston to work at KLD with Peter Kinder and Tom Koo and the team. And then when my stint there was over, I got restless. This is off the back of my first decade was working institutional investment management in South Africa, ultimately with global portfolios, working with pension funds. And so I got restless and I want to head out on my own because I had this unique combination of experience and knowledge working with institutional investors and sitting in pension fund investment committee meetings and so on. And then this experience through my MBA and then time at KLD, where I was looking at the whole research manufacturing process and the role of indexes and benchmarks. So I had that unique intersection, and I felt I could go off and do really good work. You know, quickly, I figured out that there's a lot of middle managers or people in positions of influence who would rather have a logo. And so, you know, the big four consulting firms, the strategy consultants, and so on. So my niche has always been looking for an investment shop that's either doing something and wants to do it better or not doing something, watching its peers and realize they need to get started. And my work has typically been on projects that are inevitably complex, multi-stakeholder, and importantly, where I have the ability to embed with a team and blend in versus showing up and saying, hey, this is ABC consulting company and this is how we do it. And you want our logo on whatever report you're going to deliver to your C-suite.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, what did you learn launching the Principles for Responsible Investment into the emerging markets? And I believe you started doing that in 2007. What did you learn in that process that can help sustainability-focused investors today, almost two decades later?
Well, my first reflection, you take me back to time with the UN Environment Program Finance Initiative with Paul Clements Hunt, who pretty much is the person who helped frame environmental, social, and governance, ESG, as terminology. There were many others active in the area at the time. Working from an office in Geneva, my first insight was, well, there's lots of work that's happening across stakeholders and from the UN that's a lot like startups because we're a pretty scrappy unit trying to stretch things, trying to make things happen. James Gifford, who headed the Principles for Responsible Investment, did small strategic things like figuring out how to use a URL, unpri.org, that's been so influential. The challenge with Principles for Responsible Investment, and what I could see immediately coming from South Africa, was how do you apply this in other jurisdictions with markets that are still developing or in different stages of development, often with very different dynamics in the market. For example, one of the classic differentiators in emerging markets is the actual stock exchange may often be sponsored by the government or be a quasi-government entity because the government has tried to establish that because it's trying to build capital markets, because it's trying to professionalize investment in country and or attract global investors who want an efficient and effective market system. So that's just one small example of emerging markets. So what I learned very quickly was you can't take the same message to Malaysia that you can to South Africa, that you can take to Brazil, that you can take to Ukraine, very different messages. And I would say what's different today, and partly this is informed in my class and in my first class every year, I use an interview from WHYY with Peter Kinder from 1993. And I use it to share with my students because I want them to know, hey, lots of this happened well before you arrived. And look how much is the same and look how much is different. And when I think back to what we were doing with the PRI in emerging markets in 2007 is very much what has been echoed by one of the experts that I interviewed, Shannon Matthews, who works at Lazard in Chicago, is you can really do something. If you are determined, if you're smart enough, you work in a small team, you can actually shape a conversation, you can open ideas, you can get meetings, you can convince people. And there were more, it seemed daunting at the time, like how are we going to take this concept of principles for responsible investment from Geneva to the world? This is before PRI moved across to London. And the point is, you could, if you framed it, if you worked with people who are in country, there were many fellow travelers that you could find. You would just have to look to adapt the message and the key elements of that persuasive narrative to the local market. And it was possible.
Mm. Now, Graham, today we've got just as many emerging markets around the world that we had as that probably more than we had in 2007. Is that message still going well with those types of markets, especially in times like now when there's a lot of volatility in the international investment space? Are emerging markets still focused the way that they you helped them become in 2007?
Well, again, not to attribute too much to me, and there was a whole team. And my first, the first place I'd look to answer that is to look at what are locals doing in that market. And understand there's always two things happening. There's the internal investment view and the external. Of course, if global investors at the margin have a greater influence on share price movements, or most importantly, in emerging markets, it's often the debt markets. So what's happening with sovereign debt, of course, will ripple through the pricing of corporate debt. And so if that sovereign debt pricing at the margin is being priced by global investors, then indeed, global investors will have a big say. For example, I remember back a decade and a half ago, building a sustainability index at the Istanbul Stock Exchange, more than 50% of the activity of investors on that exchange was global investors, not local investors. So it's important to understand that. So there's always going to be these two conversations that I have with each other, but they're effectively they're separate conversations. And indeed, if you're a global investor, you're watching what the local investors do, because sometimes the local investors have information advantage. So I would say the first way to answer that question would be to check with how developed is the practice of integrating environmental, social, and governance factors into investment practice by local practitioners, and then checking that against what's happening globally. And we've seen some to and fro and in terms of global investors. Adeline Dieb at Bloomberg Intelligence has numbers out on the growth of the market. And this is even after the green hushing and the ESG backlash. I've got a note here, $35 trillion US dollars in assets under management projected by 2030. That's after an 85% growth slowdown. So that's kind of factoring in this slowdown. That's still a huge chunk of money, maybe $1 in $5 globally. So where that money is looking to include environmental, social, and governance factors, it can have a big impact on what's happening in emerging markets. And my final point would be, in a way, I'm looking to those markets now for encouragement. I'm standing here in the US, working globally, and I'm looking for positive examples because it's pretty crushing right now. Science is being destroyed and threats against climate and so on. Just this morning, the US is being pulled from the international negotiations on maritime pollution. And if you go to emerging markets, you'll start to see some really encouraging examples. Singapore, Indonesia, Malaysia, Nigeria, really encouraging examples of how locals are shaping a new kind of investment practice that always includes environmental, social, and governance practice.
Yes, I've been saying to people that I work with on a day-to-day basis, yourself included, for years, that the emerging markets are where the real action is happening for investors with a stomach for some volatility on a global basis, because they're leapfrogging many of the technologies that we are now still trying to figure out how to go beyond in the developed markets. So your idea for the access to nutrition index, leverage the competitive instincts of food and beverage companies. Now, once again, we're going back almost two decades to in your time of experience in the industry, but nearly two decades later, are the companies in that sector of the economy still competing to be better?
Paul, it's, one would like to believe, we know that consumer goods, fast-moving consumer goods, as they're called, are enormously competitive. Maybe you too know of someone who's worked at a branded food company where literally if you bring the wrong brand, their competitor brand, if you bring a can of Coke to a Pepsi household, you'll probably be asked not to open it. I've had that experience. It was awkward, but then I quickly understood what was happening. The food and beverage companies will remain very, very competitive. It's an enormously complex industry, long supply chains, fiercely competitive battles for shelf space, complex models, because sometimes their competitors are the white label products of the retailers where they're looking to put stuff on the shelf. Unfortunately, a lot of the work, that particular project focused on food manufacturers, the largest global food manufacturers, and looking to have them compete on the investment case for nutrition. So could we get them, these food manufacturers, to look at how they marketed, how their manufacturers manufactured, what were the ingredients? Could we help them develop products that had a better nutrition profile? We worked very hard, 5 years working with it. There was a whole team. It was headed by the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition with money from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the Children's Investment Fund. And we developed an index. And subsequently, there's been other iterations. But for me, the shock, Paul, came in 2021 when a Financial Times writer carried a report that came from inside Nestle. And Nestle was always in the top three, you know, over the years. And the report was from an internal Nestle report using the Australian system. Australia has a specific nutrition system, like a STAR system. As many countries around the world have tried to explain nutrition to consumers. And this particular study had found that Nestle's own study of against the Australian rating system presented something like 2 out of 3 of their food and beverage products sold in that market failed that rating system, were 2 stars or less. And for me, that was a reminder that while the competitive dynamic still works, you know, every brand manager at every fast-moving consumer company knows exactly how many SKUs they're selling in which retail allocations and on which shelf they're selling boxes of something. And yet, the heart of the matter, what is the nutrition value of what you're selling? And that's what investors are effectively allocating capital towards, fails. So I think still today, there is that competition, but we need to keep nudging food and beverage companies, it's just one example, towards making and retailing, responsibly marketing to the right audiences, not to kids under 6, products that are healthier and with a lower impact.
Okay, so now, Graham, for this last question, we're not only going to change the dynamics of the conversation away from academia, well, partly, and into another sector of the economy. Because in August of 2024, last year, you launched the Sustainable Enterprise Executive Education and Development Program, that's SEED, S-E-E-D, associated with Villanova University College of Engineering. Now, will investors help us win the race to zero through programs like this that you're developing?
Well, I'd certainly hope they can. They can certainly be an important part of that and a critical stakeholder. Just one short edit there. The SEED program at Villanova, it's a joint venture with the business school and the engineering school. It was built up by Professor Carl Schmidt and Victoria Minerva at the College of Engineering over many years. And they've done such important work. Remember, anything you see at a university had to be designed and built and funded. and then where you had to find the audience that are seeking that education. It's true that the program has had a huge impact. It's delivered both as an academic program, but also as a specialist program for companies. So we've had companies whose product you've flown on or have helped be some part of the buildings you've worked and lived in. We've had companies like that that do middle management or senior management programs with us. There's five professors who teach into that. So my course is always focused on the investment case. And crucial to that, and how I began each of my expert interviews, is I ask that question, what do investors want? In some ways, I stand here today, Paul, to build on your question, which is, what is going to be the impact? Investors have a crucial role to play. Investors traditionally have looked for risk and return as the keys to the calculus. We know, since at least Sir Ronald Cohen's seminal lecture at Harvard Business School in the mid-2000s, that we also have a large number of investors who now care about impact. So risk, return, and impact, it's actually a threefold factor investigation. Now, to be clear, you can still have conventional or traditional investments, basically rolling around the world, hoovering up businesses and deploying money. The reality is nowadays that pretty much every institutional investor, when they allocate money, they're allocating money with a mandate. The better financial advisors or wealth managers who obviously manage your millions, Paul Ellis, will come to you and say, well, Paul, what are your goals with your wealth? Where are you taking it? How many yachts do you need this year, Paul? And then we'll help you figure out, well, what is that kind of mandate that then you're going to allocate to your asset managers? So investors, whether they are small investors, institutional investors, long-term investors, are all looking for risk, return, and they bear some responsibility and they share the opportunity for the impact of those investments. And now we're looking to nudge towards more positive, less negative. There are more and more opportunities out there. But very much that's at the crux of what it means to be making the sustainable investment case. And one final point. A good company can be a bad investment. A bad company can be a good investment. Generic terms, talking quickly. And the art and the science is in being very purposeful and deliberate about how you develop the strategy towards your investment, how you track that over time against which benchmarks, and use that voice of the investor. So not just owning the shares, but your portfolio company stewardship and showing up at the annual meetings, showing up in letters to the investor relations and so on. That voice of the investor, and the investor that looks at all factors, including environmental, social, and governance factors, is the crucial vector through which we can help make the sustainable investment case.
Graham, thank you so much for your time today. It's great to speak with fellow travelers like yourself who've been in this part of the industry for many years and are comfortable just maneuvering within all of the complex situations that come up from a policy and political standpoint as well as economic. Tell our followers now where online they can go to learn more about your work in sustainable investment, and especially how can they get in touch with you with questions about the many topics that we've already discussed in today's episode.
Well, thank you for that invitation, Paul. So I'm at ESG Architect on Blue Sky. I'm on LinkedIn, Graham Sinclair. I'm also still on the Broken Bird website, but I stop by there maybe once a week now. And of course, if you go to the Villanova University or the Harvard University websites, you can do a search and find the courses I'm teaching there. I'd also like to announce that partly because of this fun activity of being on your podcast, Paul, I will this summer be recording season 2 of the ESG and Coffee podcast. And I hope your listeners might find that interesting too.
Yes, I'm sure they will, and make sure that we have the link for that to access it when you start your production again. So thanks very much again to Graham Sinclair. He's MBA, adjunct professor, sustainable enterprise executive and development at Villanova, and he teaches courses at the Harvard Extension School on an annual basis. This year is what, the sixth year for the course that you're in, in right now in the spring semester. Is that correct?
It'll be the fifth year next year. Okay. This fall, 2025, I get to teach a new course, co-teach with Jason Grillo on carbon dioxide removal.
Great. That will be very interesting, I'm sure. Thanks again for your time today, Graham, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you, Paul.
I'm Paul Ellis, and this is the Sustainable Finance Podcast.